This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Suddenly, the system recalls a guilt. A wave of records show fossil fuel executives and big corporations knew their products would cause disastrous global damage for decades. Should they be charged with homicide? From Public Citizen, David R. Cush makes the case. From Rutgers, journalism professor Melissa Aronczyk on greenwashing the Canadian tar sands, we investigate corporate propaganda trying to dress up one of the dirtiest fuels in the world. Plus more AI climate music, free for you to use. Even the machine wants justice. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. David R. Cush is up in 40 seconds.
If you knew the heat was coming, but made money anyway. You knew the seas would rise, but did not say. How many super yachts, houses, and young wives can add up to a million lives? We are waiting until justice comes for people lost to the burning sun, climate homicide. Climate homicide.
For over 50 years, big fossil fuel companies had internal warnings their products would cause massive deaths and destabilize the climate. Now experts find millions of people died due to climate change. Should these companies or their executives and directors be charged with homicide? Two American legal experts say yes. David R. Cush is the director of Public Citizen's Climate Program and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. A Harvard-trained lawyer, R. Cush is recognized as an advocate and campaigner for consumer rights. David also taught at the University of Richmond School of Law, and he appears regularly in major news outlets. Last year, R. Cush teamed up with Public Citizen's Aaron Rugenberg for an article about climate homicide in Harvard Environmental Law Review. Now he works with Donald Brahman from George Washington University, presenting climate homicide events at top law schools, including Harvard, University of Chicago, and Yale. From Washington, D.C., David R. Cush, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Alex.
At first, your proposals seem outrageous and impossible, but you make a good case. It takes about over 75 pages to do it. It's a great case. Are you getting some support for criminal prosecutions for mass death by fossil fuels?
We are seeing support, and actually I would say support is growing more quickly than I expected. I think there are two reasons. One, that the scale of the wrongdoing is enormous, and it's obvious to a lot of people at a gut level that it ought to be criminal. And second, the legal theory is strong. It's actually right. So I think, in fact, the way you just spoke about it is the reaction a lot of people have, including, for example, some former prosecutors, right? We've talked to some former prosecutors from the U.S. Justice Department, and they'll say, you know, when we first heard from you, we thought, this is outrageous, this is a joke, you got to be kidding me. But then, you know, then I read the article, and then I sort of stuck with it and kept thinking about it, and the more it dawned on me, there's really something here, and I want to look into it more and think about it more.
So we're going to discuss precedents like tobacco and opioids, but first let's clear up a couple of immediate questions listeners may have. First, corporations are considered persons under U.S. law. Are you and Donald Brahman looking into charging corporations or their executives or both?
Our main focus is on the corporations themselves. I think the overriding concern in this space should be how we can prevent this harm from continuing. You know, I believe that these are crimes, and I believe that the crimes are still ongoing. And so the most important goal is to stop those harms and to prevent some of the horrors that we know are to come. And frankly, that's more important to me than punishing people, individual people, for what's happened in the past. At the same time, yes, executives can be charged as well, and it might well make sense to charge them. And I think, you know, those types of decisions would be up to individual prosecutors.
And secondly, when you say homicide, are you talking about common murder charges? Please describe the varieties of homicide.
Sure. Well, homicide is a general legal term that means causing a death with a culpable mental state. There are multiple kinds of homicide. It's sort of like the blanket term for any kind of homicide. And they are largely defined, actually, by the mental state. So there's negligent homicide, if you cause death negligently. If you were reckless, maybe it's escalated to what we would call involuntary manslaughter. And again, these terms can vary in different jurisdictions, but this is sort of a general typology. And if you're extremely reckless, you know, if you showed, a severe indifference to human life, that can even be called murder, what we would call depraved heart murder. There's also misdemeanor manslaughter. There's felony murder. So we looked at, Don Brayman and I looked at every form of homicide except for what is sort of thought of generally as first-degree murder, sort of killing somebody with premeditated malice ahead of time. We looked at every other type of homicide, and we concluded that in jurisdictions across the United States, fossil fuel companies could probably be charged with virtually any kind of homicide aside from first-degree murder, which we didn't look at.
Well, as you touched on, essential to any criminal case is mens rea, Latin for a guilty mind. How do you document that in a fossil fuel company?
Sure. You document it by showing what the people within the company knew, including people who had authority and responsibility for the relevant actions. And we can see it here, pretty clearly from a bunch of the industry's own internal documents. And there, frankly, will probably be more that comes to light in the coming years publicly. But from documents we already have publicly, it's very clear that this is an industry that knew roughly a half century ago, possibly longer, that global warming was going to cause, was caused by primarily by burning fossil fuels, by their own product, and that it was going to lead to globally catastrophic harm. That phrase, globally catastrophic, is a quote from a 1980 document from the American Petroleum Institute. And if you look over these documents, you can see what kind of global catastrophes they had in mind. They talk about entire nations' agricultural output being destroyed. If you think that's going to happen without anyone dying, then you're crazy. They talk about coastal cities being inundated by flooding. They talk about the entire world's GDP coming to a halt by 2030. Again, if you think that kind of economic chaos is going to happen without anyone dying, I don't know what you're thinking. They talk about the tropics becoming, quote, less habitable. The tropics are currently home to 3 billion people. So they knew that this was going to be globally catastrophic. That's their term. And by globally catastrophic, they meant the types of harm, economic, ecological, extreme weather, that was obviously going to lead to many, many people being killed. Oh, the other way, by the way, you know about their mens rea is that they lied about it, right? You don't generally lie about what you're doing or about whether it's going to harm anybody and engage in an elaborate campaign of deception unless you realize it's wrong and that other people are going to dislike it.
Have some corporations been charged with homicide or similar crimes before?
Certainly. Most recently, there were charges against BP as a result of deaths in the Deep Horizon oil rig explosion in Gusher in 2010. PG&E has been charged with homicide in association with multiple of the California wildfires in recent years. We don't see homicide charges against major corporations nearly as often as we should, perhaps, but it's certainly a thing that happens. It's not uncommon.
And then from ex-President Richard Nixon to the recent ex-president, charges often result from the cover-up as much as the original crime. How did the fossil fuel giants hide the lethal products that they were putting out there?
Yeah, well, so what's interesting is we know that they believed the climate science because while they were sort of denying it publicly, they took actions to modify their business operations in ways that would make them more resilient to climate harms. So, for example, they raised the height of offshore oil platforms to accommodate their own predictions of sea level rise. But when it comes to the public, they launched a really massive campaign of deception and distortion to dispute climate science and cast doubt on it. They sponsored think tanks and nonprofits to get out their phony message. They advertised directly to consumers. They're still doing that. They're still vastly overstating their own investments in clean energy, and while they actually, you know, raise their fossil fuel production in ways that are essentially world destroying. They sponsored ads in major newspapers that looked like editorials. They did it with their own words and executive speeches and so on. And you're absolutely right, though, that, you know, sometimes it's a cover-up as much as the original crime. You know, in the tobacco industry, there never was accountability, criminal accountability, for all their harm and mayhem. The closest we got was a civil RICO suit by the Justice Department over their deceptions, which they did, which, you know, Justice actually did successfully essentially prosecute them for deception, although that was a civil case.
One defense used by big tobacco and again by big oil: billions of people wanted our products, so we only produced what the public demanded. Is that a good defense?
You know, it's really not a good defense legally. So the way a court would look at this is whether it counts as what's called an intervening act that breaks the chain of causation. And what that really gets at, that whole sort of doctrine, is whether the harm that occurred was reasonably foreseeable, or whether something unexpected happened that contributed more to the harm. I think you're going to have a hard time in court as a fossil fuel company saying it was unexpected that consumers use your products precisely as you intended them to. You know, many oil and gas companies own gas stations, and they pump the gas directly into cars. They can't really blame what happens next on consumers.
And both industries also claim they met all the government regulations and laws, and including the tax requirements, although I doubt they really paid much taxes. So how could fossil fuel interests be charged with a crime if they've met all the government rules and laws?
Well, I think first I would actually dispute that everything they did was legal. And I think it's important to remember this wasn't all legal activity, right? They lied about what they were doing. They lied about the impacts. They are accused of consumer fraud, securities fraud, antitrust violations, conspiracy, RICO, and more. So this isn't actually, I think, a case of a company just legally selling a product. But second, even if it were, that's actually not determinative in criminal law. You can do things that are otherwise legal, but if they're going to cause a death and you have a culpable mental state, you can still be liable for homicide. So, to make a really simple example, it's legal for me to make and sell a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. But if I know a child has a severe peanut allergy and I make them a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and they die, I might be liable for homicide.
And until relatively recently, the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma pushed opioids into a billion-dollar product. At times, they were accused of bribing doctors with vacations and other rewards for prescribing very addictive drugs like OxyContin. Some estimated more than 200,000 Americans alone died due to overdoses from those opioids. But again, no homicide charges against them. How was that resolved?
Well, so it hasn't been entirely resolved yet. So there's been a settlement with Purdue Pharma and to some extent with the Sacklers that would provide billions of dollars in restitution to people harmed and would restructure Purdue Pharma into a public benefit company that, among other things, it would provide low-cost or free medications to treat addiction and overdoses and would donate proceeds to addiction abatement programs. But the settlement is actually still tied up in legal wrangling. The parties can back out of it depending on what happens in Purdue Pharma's bankruptcy proceedings. And the Justice Department, the U.S. Justice Department, is objecting to the bankruptcy settlement that has been preliminarily reached because it gives the Sacklers really wide-ranging legal immunity, right? Justice Department actually wants the ability to possibly still go after them. So we'll see how that comes out, and we'll see whether the Justice Department, in fact, does go after them.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Should fossil fuel producers be charged with climate homicide? We talk with legal expert and public advocate David R. Cush from Public Citizen. Various actors already launched civil lawsuits against fossil fuel producers in many countries. And how is that going, in your opinion?
Lately, they've been going pretty well. In Montana recently, a group of kids just won a huge victory against the government arguing that the Montana state constitution protects their right to a healthy environment. And that before everybody goes and runs and gets ideas, there are a few other states with constitutional provisions like this, but not a huge number. It was actually it was a special amendment that was adopted decades ago. And they basically argued that the state's approval of fossil fuel projects without considering climate harms violated their rights under this constitutional right to a healthy environment. It was a fantastically huge victory. And there are dozens, at least 40 other cases in the U.S. against fossil fuel companies, mostly by municipalities and states. And after years of legal wrangling and, you know, procedural objections and roadblocks by the industry, they're starting to move forward. There's a few that are moving forward toward discovery and trial. So things are really looking up, I would say, on the civil side.
Why are criminal charges needed then?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, I want to be clear. I think that this is a both and. You know, I think the civil suits are extremely important and will be fruitful. And I support them. And I support plenty of other climate measures. Criminal law is another possible tool that has been neglected, and I think it has something to contribute. So to me, the climate crisis is an all-hands-on-deck moment. We need every possible tool and every strategy. And it has a few unique aspects, right? Criminal law is how we as a society ultimately say what is right and wrong, right? What is permitted and what is just not permitted. It's different than a lot of other areas. It's different than civil lawsuits, where in a civil lawsuit, the bottom line is you're saying somebody caused me harm, so they owe me money. In criminal law, you're saying somebody did something that is morally wrong and deserves some of the highest sort of moral disapproval and sanction that we can muster as a society. Prosecutors also have powers and abilities that civil litigants don't necessarily have. They may have remedies that are available to them. And, you know, for the same reason that a lot of us take the threat of criminal sanction very seriously, the defendants might take it very seriously as well. So there's a lot that criminal prosecutions could contribute.
More than a dozen countries passed laws making ecocide a crime, including France, Georgia, and the Ukraine. In your opinion, does Congress need to pass new laws to enable a conviction for this gross thing of destabilizing the atmosphere and all natural systems?
So, yeah, that's an interesting question. It certainly wouldn't hurt. I don't think it's necessary. That, you know, there are a lot of laws on the books, a lot of relevant criminal laws, not just homicide, but other possible laws that fossil fuel companies and others could be prosecuted under, including things like reckless endangerment, or some states have a law against causing or risking catastrophe. Those types of laws might already, you know, fairly encompass things like destabilizing the atmosphere and natural systems. They could certainly use more enforcement, and they might need better or stronger penalties or that sort of thing, but there are a lot of laws out there that could maybe fit the bill already.
You and Donald Braman write, quote, "This article is not suggesting that imprisonment or the abrupt cessation of fuel production should be a core objective," end quote. Why not? And what do you seek?
In general, I don't think that putting people in jail is the best solution in a lot of criminal cases. And I think in this era of mass incarceration and systemic racism, I'm guessing a lot of your listeners might agree. And I think I said this before, but for me, the overriding objection is to end the ongoing harm. And putting individuals in jail might help with that to some extent, but there are even more direct approaches. And what I would like to see most is a criminal consequence for fossil fuel corporations that reformed the companies themselves. So again, along the lines of this model of what might happen in the case of Purdue Pharma, imagine reforming fossil fuel companies and requiring them to become part of the solution. Right? Imagine there's a prosecution against them as a conspiracy, and part of the terms of the settlement is that their corporate charters have to be rewritten to make them help, you know, facilitate as quickly as possible the transition to clean energy and to donate their proceeds to restitution for past harms, for resilience and adaptation, for communities that are in harm's way, and those types of measures. You know, to me, that would be sort of the gold standard of a solution. Now, it's a sort of devil-in-the-details solution if there ever was one, right? You'd have to make sure that the terms of that charter are written properly, that there's good oversight, that there's good enforcement of the terms, and so on and so forth. But in terms of putting us, stemming the harm and putting us on a better pathway, I think that would be a lot more effective than, for example, just throwing somebody in jail.
So I guess that's what you are calling restructuring fossil fuel companies as public benefit corporations. It's a little hard for us to understand how that can work because the product that they're selling is deadly. They basically have to stop selling it and we have to stop using it. That may take some time, but that's what has to happen. So it's hard to see how they're going to generate revenue that could, say, go into new wind or solar energy unless they're selling their oil and gas and coal.
Well, you know, they're doing some work in renewable energy. Again, it's a tiny fraction of what they do. And plenty of other companies are, right? I mean, there's no reason they can't be mobilizing their vast workforces, piles of cash that they are sitting on. You know, there was an article yesterday that some of the oil companies are sitting on so much cash now and have so much inflowing income that they barely need bank loans anymore. You know, some of these companies are so big that they don't need bank loans. They barely need insurance. They're just sitting, you know, they have mountains and mountains of cash. You know, they can invest it in something different than what they've been doing. Right? They can move toward renewable energy. There are plenty of profitable renewable energy companies. In fact, you know, some of the fossil fuel CEOs have recently been quoted saying, yeah, there's money to be made in renewable energy, just not quite as much as we're making in oil and gas, right? And we're going to stick with the thing that is making us the most money. So you could certainly, a court could certainly order them as a criminal sanction, or they could agree as part of a settlement of criminal charges to restructure and just pursue a different type of business.
And the fossil fuel industry is famously secretive. We hardly know who is in control and who has the ownership positions. Competitive information is often confused with national secrets when you've got national oil and gas companies. Does this make criminal charging harder, and is there a better way to manage this resource?
There are certainly going to be better ways to manage this lethal resource. I won't dispute that. In terms of the secrecy of the industry, that's absolutely right. I have not heard that it would be a problem. I think prosecutors will be able to deal with those issues given their investigatory powers. I haven't really even heard it's a problem in the civil cases. But I can tell you we've been talking to people in the space, both who are involved in civil litigation and, as I said, we've talked to former prosecutors, and this hasn't been a thing that people have really flagged. I think that they will be able to get to the bottom of it.
Okay. And we see state-run companies from Saudi Arabia to Norway, they're expanding their extinction-level production as much as private corporations like ExxonMobil. Should Exxon, Chevron, and their ilk be taken over by a government body? And does that hold any better promise of a planned exit from the industry?
I mean, it's a great question. Obviously, whether the government does a good job on something depends on who controls the government and what they're trying to accomplish and what kinds of transparency and democratic accountability mechanisms there are. So all that is to say, I don't think that just the government taking over these companies would necessarily resolve much. I think even if we don't say rewrite corporate charters in the way that I was just discussing, there may well come a day in the U.S. even when there are calls for the U.S. government to take over some oil companies as our fossil fuel use winds down. Right. So if we were to actually get on track with the clean energy transition at a pace that is closer to what the science says we need, we can't stop fossil fuel production tomorrow. We could, but it would actually be disastrous, right? I mean, the economy is still too entangled with fossil fuels. It would be extremely disruptive. It would hurt a lot of people, including people of color and marginalized communities, in some ways some of the worst. So what we need to do is sort of wind down fossil fuels as quickly as possible, but also sort of in an orderly way that minimizes disruption. Now, my guess is if we are on a march toward transitioning to 100% clean energy or very near that, there may well come a day where private individuals, investors don't really care to own fossil fuel companies anymore, but we still need some fossil fuels. Right. So imagine we need 5% of the oil that we need today. I'm not sure that anybody wants to be holding the pump as the last few drops of oil come out of it. And so there may well be a time where people go running to the federal government for bailouts or that sort of thing. And I think it would behoove us to be ready for that. It'd be some time in the future, but to make sure that there are plans in place to take over the industry and keep winding fossil fuels down as quickly as possible and do so in a way that doesn't reward irresponsibility and past wrongdoing, you know, with big bailouts and giveaways, and also do so in a way that takes care of the workers and the communities who are going to be affected.
The head of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, just said humanity has only 2 years left to act on climate before permanent damage is done. We know getting anyone to lay charges and then the delays in court wrangling will take years. My concern with your investigation into homicide charges for fossil fuel companies, as legitimate as it is, offers a kind of false hope while emissions continue to build. How do you see that?
Yeah, well, I guess one response, not to be too cheeky, is I'm curious what you think is happening quicker. No climate solution is being implemented fast enough. And I think, you know, we need everything we can get right away. And criminal prosecutions may end up being slower than other options that make more progress sooner. They may end up being quicker. And I think we should be pursuing everything that we can. And I also think that multiple different types of climate mitigation strategies contribute to one another and build on one another. I think there's value in more people beginning to realize and understand that this conduct that we're talking about is actually criminal and that it could be prosecuted. Even if no prosecutions actually happen, I think it helps people, you know, sort of focuses the mind and helps people realize the stakes and who we're dealing with and what types of behavior we're dealing with in ways that might contribute to other solutions, and sort of strengthen the climate action or the climate movement generally.
But talking about charging oil, gas, and coal companies or executives and directors with criminal homicide, it's not going to be received well by an industry that likes to be in charge. Have you had any pushback to this article?
You know, there hasn't been much yet, to be honest. I can't imagine the industry likes what we're saying, but we haven't heard much in response. I could speculate about why that is, but I really don't know. And we'll see what happens.
But on the other hand, of course, millions of people probably think such charges are long overdue. Does homicide for mass climate deaths become a movement, or are you looking for a test case somewhere in the world, or what? Talk to us about next steps.
Well, but, you know, there is a growing accountability movement in the climate space. People, this is associated with the civil lawsuits. It's associated with calls to make polluters pay. And there are bills that are passing now in state legislatures they get called sort of climate superfund laws to make the fossil fuel industry pay for past harms, pay for the damage they've done. So there's certainly a growing movement for this type of accountability. And I think in general, what the accountability movement is seeking, you know, fits pretty well within a lot of what the climate movement is seeking. You know, I think it's just sort of part of the climate movement in general, in a lot of ways. You know, our next steps are sort of just getting the word out and educating people, both the general public and the legal profession. And, you know, we have a lot of research and writing planned. There's a lot of detail. Yeah, we're right in the broad brushstrokes. I think that we've got strong arguments, but there's a lot to be worked out in terms of some of the details. You know, we want to make sure that what we're saying is airtight and we address all of the sort of nooks and crannies and questions that can come up. We're certainly thinking about what would be the right kinds of case or cases to bring. There's plenty of work to do. And then, you know, so some of that's work with the media, some of it's work with legal scholars and former prosecutors and law students. And there's also going to be, I think, plenty of work for activists who want to raise awareness about this and are interested in their, you know, local DA or their attorney general pursuing an investigation of fossil fuel industry for criminal charges.
From the nonprofit consumer group Public Citizen, we've been speaking with David R. Cush, the director of Public Citizen's Climate Program. With Donald Brayman, David published the article Climate Homicide, Prosecuting Big Oil for Climate Deaths, and that is also covered in the New Republic magazine. You can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org, and do check out www.citizen.org. David, thank you for your pursuit of climate justice and talking with us today.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
I'm waiting until justice comes for people lost to the burning sun, climate homicide. If you knew the heat was coming, the made money anyway, you the seas would rise, but did not say how many super yachts, houses and young wives can add up to 2 million lives, like the old man from the death camp, spring them back to stand. Comes for people lost to the burning sun, climate homicide. If you knew the heat was coming, but made money anyway, you knew the seas would rise, but did not say.
At the start of May, the American Senate held their hearings titled Denial, Disinformation, and Doublespeak, Big Oil's Evolving Efforts to Avoid Accountability for Climate Change. A whole lot more proof emerged of what fossil fuel corporations knew about climate change and when, dating back to the 1950s. The climate impact was certain and clear to them by the 1970s. Since then, ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, Total, Chevron, all the oil national companies have financed deception, distraction, and lies. Next, we have a case in point how Big Oil in Alberta, Canada formed a common lobby group, a sort of front group and public relations campaign. They want us to believe nice Canadian heavy oil is better than those foreign products. The atmosphere does not agree.
Radio EcoShock.
A group of experienced media analysts just published this study, Greenwashing, Net Zero, and the Oil Sands in Canada, The Case of Pathways Alliance. A co-author is Dr. Melissa Aronczyk. She is professor of journalism and media studies at the School of Communication and Information at Rutgers University. Melissa's research shows how public relations shapes our perception of environmental crises and influences our responses to them. Her most recent co-authored book is A Strategic Nature, Public Relations and the Politics of American Environmentalism. From New Jersey, Melissa Aronczyk, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for inviting me to speak with you.
Well, just to get us started, how do you define greenwashing?
The most straightforward definition I can give you is that greenwashing happens when you promote your product, your organization, or your services as being more green, more environmentally friendly than they really are. A more science-based definition of greenwashing accounts for different ways that an organization engages in deceptive or misleading activities to create false positive perceptions of how an organization is doing in terms of its environmental performance. For example, researchers might look at how an organization leaves out key information in their environmental claim, information that a consumer would need to understand what the organization is saying. Or a researcher might look at how the measurements that an organization is using to claim environmental progress are undercounted.
Who are the companies forming the Pathways Alliance in Canada?
The Paupres Alliance is a coalition of the six largest oil sands companies in Canada. You have Canadian Natural, Cenovus Energy, ConocoPhillips Canada, Imperial Oil, MEG, and Suncor Energy. Together, these companies make up 95% of Canadian oil sands production, so they've pretty much got the market covered. All of those companies are headquartered in Alberta, but of course, these are not just Canadian companies. Imperial Oil is majority owned by Exxon, for example, and ConocoPhillips is an American brand.
Your group found a lot in open records. Where did you look, and does this alliance try to hide things?
Paupres Alliance is basically a publicity machine. They have tons of tar sands information and promotional material out there because their goal is to influence public opinion as well as political decision-making. So what we did as researchers was find everything we could that was out there by or about Paupres Alliance, and we chose a two-year period. So we went from June 2021 to June 2023. We wanted to show the range and the scale of their promotional activities. So we started with their websites. There are two Paupres Alliance websites, oilsandspathways.ca and pathwaysalliance.ca. And then we looked at the individual company websites, those six companies I mentioned a minute ago. After that, we searched news databases to find all the news media coverage, mentions of Paupres, podcasts, press releases, and we also collected images that showed their ad placements. I'm sure as Canadians have probably seen, they had ads just covering the Canadian landscape on buses, planes, sports stadiums, that kind of thing. And then finally, we filed open records requests, which are called in Canada ATIPs. ATIPs stand for Access to Information and Privacy. And any Canadian citizen can file an ATIP. Those give Canadian citizens the right to access government records. To your question of does the Paupres Alliance try to hide things, there are two kinds of hiding that I'd say Paupres Alliance engages in. One is to hide from the public what their plans to reach net zero really mean. So Paupres has an elaborate net zero plan, and that includes a 400-kilometer transportation line and a carbon capture and storage sequestration site. But it's not made at all clear in most of their net zero communication that Alliance members actually intend to expand production of fossil fuels. So as a result, we concluded in our article that their net zero plan is really a strategy for allowing increased emissions in the near term. The other way Paupres Alliance hides things is kind of like hiding in plain sight. And this is a classic greenwashing tactic. You know, if you claim that you're on a path to net zero, what are you really saying? Nobody really knows. And that's kind of the point. Paupres uses a lot of vague or unprovable claims. They aggregate numbers from different sources to say that Canadian oil is a better barrel of oil than oil from other countries. But that kind of thing is really hard. It makes it very hard for ordinary consumers to evaluate what they're saying.
And do the oil sands companies tell us what they want? How do they describe the future?
When we were doing the research for our journal article, I remember listening to a podcast interview with the president of Paupres Alliance, Kendall Dilling. And he was talking about how the world is going to continue to need oil for a very long time. And then he said the goal of Paupres Alliance is therefore to deliver what he calls a better barrel of oil, by which he means, you know, the development of a massive technology infrastructure for carbon capture and storage. At the end of that interview, Mr. Dilling also mentioned the advantages of oil for an ongoing non-combustion market. So not just the emissions from burning the oil, but also for products that are made from oil derived from the oil sands. And he concluded by saying there's no sunset for this industry. And that, I think, really sums up the view of Paupres Alliance for the future.
So looking through their publications, the websites and all that, do Paupres Alliance members accept the need for an energy transition?
That's a complicated one. I would say Paupres Alliance recognize the need for an energy transition, at least on the face of it. So again, their net zero communications does claim that an energy transition would take place, but they see the product of their companies as very much part of that energy transition. And I don't think that's the kind of energy transition that a lot of other people are talking about when they say we need an energy transition. For some people, that means really moving away from fossil fuels as a primary source of energy.
Are alliance members reducing emissions, and how does that square with their profit goals and the new pipelines they're building to deliver more product?
That's a tough question, because we found several indicators of greenwashing in Pathways Alliance's public communication. If you look at their public messaging in the big picture over 2 years, as we did, there are fundamental questions not answered regarding the sector's emissions. We really can't tell whether the emissions are declining or rising, and one of the reasons for that is that the baseline for emissions is very unclear. It's kind of like, you know, a shifting starting point, which, again, you know, makes it really hard for consumers to understand what they mean when they say emissions are declining. The other thing is that information about the cost of the Pathways Alliance plan and the amount of public investment that would be needed to realize that plan isn't available. So, in other words, we don't know how much money is required to create this massive technological infrastructural system, this carbon capture and storage system. It's really not made clear in their net zero communication that alliance members intend to expand production. So once again, it's hard not to conclude that their net zero plan isn't about a strategy to allow increased emissions in the near term, not a decrease.
So how can net zero promises be used by polluting corporations to delay real action?
Well, it comes back to something, Alex, I mentioned a minute ago. If you're making a promise of future action, which is what almost all net zero promises do, you are basically shifting the goalposts. You're making the answer to the question so far in the future that it's really hard to know whether those corporations are going to reach that goal and what they're going to be doing in the meantime. Any future promise of action, you know, net zero by 2030, by 2050, and so on, these require incredible amounts of investment and time to make those actions even thinkable. And in most cases, the investments that are requested have not been approved. So these are all still at the planning stages. Any current efforts at carbon capture and storage right now are small scale, nowhere near the kind of scale and scope that would be required to actually move the needle on emissions.
Just to add to the confusion, the oil companies play on the United Nations method of describing emissions. The UN created categories from Scope 1 to Scope 3 emissions, and few of us know what that means. Can you describe the three types of emissions the UN talks about?
Yes, scope refers to a commonly accepted categorization of greenhouse gas emissions, as you say, derived from the United Nations. Scope 1 emissions originate from sources owned or controlled by an organization. Scope 2 emissions are from the energy consumed, and Scope 3 emissions indirectly result from an organization as part of its business model or its supply and value chains. A good trick I found online for remembering how to distinguish those three scopes is burn, buy, beyond. Scope 1 is what you burn, Scope 2 is energy you buy, and Scope 3 is everything beyond that.
And how does the Pathways Alliance allow the oil sands industry to confuse the public about the real scope of their emissions?
The most consistent indicator of greenwashing we found in our research is Pathways' repeated failure to account publicly for all emissions, Scope 1, 2, and 3. The article goes into great detail about how Pathways does this, but to put it simply, we can say that they're using rather non-standard accounting techniques to calculate their emissions. In sum, a clear indication of greenwashing here is that the Scope 3 emissions are not accounted for in the Pathways Net Zero Plan. In fact, the only place in the Pathways Alliance communications that even alluded to Scope 3 was in the legalese, the tiny advisory 5-point font version of its vision deck. It's got a, you know, a 600-word legalistic cautionary statement about the limits of forward-looking claims. And right there they say something like, net zero references in this announcement apply only to Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions. But again, you have to look pretty carefully to find that statement.
So every now and then, a bright scientist or researcher publishes actual measurements of oil sands emissions and pollutions, and it's something the government could easily do instead of accepting what I think is the lowball industry reporting. How does the Pathway Alliance react when big-time undercounting is revealed and published in the newspapers?
Yes, I mean, we have seen evidence of that. I remember a year ago, the CDC published a report suggesting that prior research had been undercounting and that the newest research showed that there was considerable undercounting of oil sands emissions in Canada. One of the strategies we used in our research was to look at historical or archived snapshots of websites. Some of your listeners might be familiar with something called the Wayback Machine, and it allows you to look at what a website looked like earlier in time and compare the earlier version to today's version. So what we saw was that when any kind of accusation was leveled at either at Pathways or at one of its companies, the company would then change something on their website to avoid greater scrutiny or accusations based on what was happening. So that's what you see when undercounting is revealed. Pathways will defend its measurements, claim that they're industry standards, and then often make changes on their website to tinker with the numbers.
Some Canadian banks are so heavily invested in the oil sands, there's talk of whether the banks would collapse if the heavy oil industry did shut down. Are banks helping the industry greenwash their climate impacts?
I haven't myself done research in that area, but there are many recent instances in climate-related probes and litigation, including greenwashing claims against banks over the past 3 years. So I do think any research into this phenomenon has to look at the role that banks are playing in funding or allowing for investments to take place in the sector.
Getting to your specialty, Melissa, you study and publish books on the intersection of public relations branding and the environmental crisis. Canada and Canadians have a brand, too. We think people like us, Canadians, are supposed to be so polite and dependable. But now major oil sands companies are kind of swiping that image and wrapping their super pollution in it. How do they do it?
Alex, that's a really good way of putting it. So, you know, Canadians are known for their politeness, their dependability, their friendliness. And, you know, whether that's a stereotype or not, I think Canadians are quite proud of that image on the world stage. And what we have seen is the use of Canadian identity, these positive attributes of Canadian identity, to claim that Canadian oil is itself more dependable and friendlier than other sources of oil. Back in 2010, the conservative media personality and lobbyist Ezra Levant wrote a book called Ethical Oil, The Case for Canada's Oil Sands. Now, the primary aim of that book, Ethical Oil, was to insert a kind of moral relativism into oil consumption. He appealed to Canadian values to try to make us feel better about our reliance on carbon-based economies. And so he set up this comparison between Canadian oil and what he called conflict oil in the Middle East. What he was really doing, of course, was, as you say, wrapping Canadian oil sands into the mantle of Canadian national identity. What he was also doing was setting up our future as a Canadian society in terms of choice and self-interest in the face of inevitable and ongoing consumption. It was really troubling. I remember very well when that book came out and the publicity around it, and it seems that Pathways Alliance has just borrowed from that playbook.
The international economy is greased by big public relations firms feeding friendly mass media. Have the oil sands companies and their lobby hired PR experts?
I think it's fair to say that pretty much all oil companies, all companies, period, that want to influence public opinion or political decision-making have some relationship with public relations, whether they do it internally or externally by hiring a firm. It's as standard as having an accounting firm. Companies know that their brand represents an enormous source of value. So having a PR presence to maintain their reputation in the media and the public eye is vital, and never more so than today, where we really are a media society.
Pathways Alliance say they are all about solutions to climate change. You say they are a lobby group. Why, and who are they trying to influence with their rich resources?
Most fossil fuel coalitions have two main influence targets. One is the public, and the other is political decision makers. The public is important to influence because companies want to maintain what's called a social license to operate. And of course, political decision makers are important to influence because the companies want to make sure that any regulations that are passed are favorable to these companies. In the ATIP requests that we made of the federal government, we found scores of lobbying reports that demonstrated that Pathways Alliance representatives were meeting with government officials. So it was very straightforward for us to call them a lobby group because they spend a lot of their time lobbying.
And your paper contains a helpful table of regulations and laws in various countries against deception and fraud. Can these laws and regulations be used against greenwashing? And what countries do you think have the best and worst controls on greenwashing?
The table in our article was indeed meant to show that regulatory measures against deception and fraud around environmental claims are evolving very quickly in a lot of different places. And I think they're becoming more and more effective in raising public awareness about greenwashing and especially about the need for consumer protection. The winner, so to speak, or maybe the region that's out in front when it comes to controls on greenwashing is the European community. Just last month, the European Parliament adopted stricter measures than they already had in place, which were already pretty strict. And these new measures will ban generic environmental claims on products that are made without proof. So like I was saying earlier, these very vague or unprovable statements. They're going to ban claims that a product has a neutral or reduced or positive impact on the environment because the producer is offsetting emissions. So in other words, carbon offsets will not be considered justified in making a claim that a product has a positive impact on the environment. Finally, they're banning sustainability labels that are not based on approved certification schemes or otherwise established by public authorities. Now, in some cases, these regulations are being tied to climate litigation, and that is a really important area to watch. To give you one example, also last month, the District Court of Amsterdam found that the Dutch airline KLM was greenwashing its advertising and deemed it illegal. Now, that's a major legal precedent with very interesting implications across not only the international aviation sector, but all kinds of polluting sectors.
How's the U.S. doing on regulations and laws against greenwashing?
You know, the United States is doing better than it used to. It's true that they are not nearly as advanced when it comes to developing protections against greenwashing. Where I think we are seeing some real movement forward in the United States is in climate litigation. There are north of 20, it might even be closer to 30 by now, active climate litigation cases and more coming in various states. And they have proven very effective in forcing companies to heed the admonitions against greenwashing in a way that regulations haven't really worked.
You know, part of me did not want to read this report on tar sands misinformation. It seems so depressing. It's like entering a dangerous mirage, especially for Canadians. How do you feel after this truth-telling? And, Melissa, what are you working on next?
I think it's so important that researchers continue to surface evidence of climate disinformation and greenwashing by organizations. And for me, I actually am very optimistic. 5 years ago, most people were not even familiar with the term greenwashing. And now I think it's safe to say it's not a household word, at least something that a lot of citizens and consumers are aware of and know that it's something that they need to take action on and to hold companies to account for their statements about being environmentally friendly. I think journalists and researchers have really done an impressive job bringing greenwashing to the fore and showing consumers that they don't have to accept false or misleading claims about climate action. In terms of what I'm working on next, I do have a new book project underway. It's on very similar topics as the ones we've been discussing here. It will have to do with greenwashing throughout North America, not only in the U.S., but also in Canada and over in Europe and Mexico as well. I'm also going to continue working with my co-authors, Chris Russell and Patrick McCurdy, on greenwashing in Canada. So you'll have to stay tuned for our next article on that topic.
I hope to get that update. From Rutgers University, we've been speaking with Melissa Aronczyk, professor of journalism and media studies. You can find links to her website and books in my show blog at ecoshock.org. That's published every Wednesday. Melissa, thank you for helping us spot misinformation when we need to know.
It's really a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
What should we think of a suicidal system where we benefit until collapse comes? With a tiny prompt, this is what an artificial mind said and sang about big oil greed. It says it's a deadly plot. Even the machine knows.
Climate homicide, it's a heavy weight. Mother Nature's crying. It's hard to contemplate. The hurricanes get stronger, but fires burn hot. Their actions killing us.
It's so hard to express negative emotions about our fossil fuel lords. They rule no matter who comes to power. In Canada, we had a prime minister for 10 years who literally represented the offices of the Alberta oil and gas industry. He took away the country's only Arctic research ship and leased it out for energy exploration in the north. He muzzled Canadian climate scientists. Our next young prime minister spoke of climate action and reconnected with international negotiations. Then he spent $32 billion of taxpayers' money to construct a pipeline from the tar sands to Vancouver. All the big private corporations refused to build it, as uneconomical and very unpopular. Hundreds of people were arrested protesting this giant emissions project, including site occupation by university students and faculty. The pipeline just opened last week, feeding supertankers going through the crowded little port of Vancouver. It is Canada's shame. So ExxonMobil and all their buddies just stole our good name, glued it to their lethal products, and sold it as Canadian. They might as well take our national anthem as well. I challenge all you who live in countries of fossil fuel diggers and drillers and shippers to rewrite your own national anthem for these times. Tell it like it is. Post it somewhere. Send me a link. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. Here you go, Canada. This is for you.
Ladies and gentlemen, please stand for Canada's national anthem.
Tartar sands. Stolen from
our home and native land, true patriot love in all of us command. With glowing hearts we see thee rise, true oil strong and free from far and wide. Sands, we stand on guard for thee. keep our oil glorious and free. Oh, tar sands, we stand on guard for